Imagine you're standing at the open door of an airplane, 3,000 feet in the air, with a parachute strapped to your back.
Right, just looking down at the ground.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. And you can read the instruction manual for that parachute cover to cover. You can, I mean, fully understand the physics of drag and air resistance and how the canopy deploys.
You could even watch, 10 other people jump out ahead of you.
Yes, you see their parachutes open perfectly and they float safely to the ground. But there is this massive, terrifying gap between knowing that parachute works in theory and actually throwing yourself out of that door.
Because taking that step requires you to risk literally everything on the knowledge you've just accumulated.
Right.
It's that precipice where theory has to become reality, and you are betting your life on the outcome.
And that chasm, that space between knowing something is true and actually entrusting yourself to it, is exactly what we're exploring today in this deep dive. Welcome in, by the way. Today we're unpacking a really fascinating source document titled Reaching Trust. And it examines this exact terrifying gap, but applied to human faith. So the mission for us today is looking at the historic Protestant perspective on how a person actually achieves true security in faith. Like from a Christian standpoint, how do we get to a place of genuine, solid trust?
To really understand the gravity of that question, we kind of have to look at the cultural and theological landscape of the 16th century.
Setting the stage.
Exactly. So during the Reformation, thinkers like Martin Luther and Philip Melanchthon, they were looking at the religious practices all around them and realizing there was this massive problem.
Right.
The prevailing culture at the time operated heavily on something called implicit faith.
Implicit faith, which means what exactly?
Well, the idea was essentially that you didn't need to personally understand the theological nuances of the gospel.
Yeah.
You just needed to trust that the church had it figured out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you perform the rituals, you check the religious boxes, and you're covered.
I mean, which sounds incredibly convenient, honestly. You just sort of outsource your spiritual security to the institution. Let the experts handle the heavy lifting while you just show up and go through the motions.
Right, but Luther and Melanchthon looked at that exact system and concluded it was completely bankrupt.
They weren't buying it.
Not at all.
Yeah.
They realized that simply believing in God in this vague institutional way, or merely possessing some intellectual acknowledgement of historical events, it just wasn't getting the job done.
Yeah.
They recognized a profound difference between a dead, merely historical faith and what they called fides viva.
Fides viva, a living faith. A
Exactly.
faith that actually secures your soul rather than just filling your head with trivia or, relying on a religious institution. Let's unpack this. Because they realize that true, secure faith isn't just one monolithic block.
Right.
It has an anatomy. They broke down this saving faith into three essential interconnected components. And according to this framework, you really have to have all three for faith to be genuinely alive and salvific.
Yes, and the first of these components is a Latin term, notitia. This is the foundational layer because faith cannot exist in a vacuum, right? It must always have an object.
You have to know what you're looking at.
Exactly. Before anyone can place their faith in Jesus Christ, they first have to know who he is and what he actually accomplished. So, notitia is the intellectual comprehension of the gospel's facts.
So we're talking about the historical reality of Christ's existence, the actual data points,
Yeah.
his claims to divinity, the theological concepts of his substitutionary death, his resurrection. I kind of look at it this way. I know that Brussels sprouts exist.
Okay, where is it going?
I know they contain vitamins, right? I know they are theoretically good for the human body, but possessing that knowledge doesn't magically force me to put them on my plate and eat them.
The knowledge leaves you personally unchanged. You have the data, sure, but the data alone doesn't actually nourish you.
Now, I do have to push back on this a little bit because starting this entire framework with a requirement for intellectual data feels a bit, I don't know, elitist.
Elitist how?
Well, if notitia is the mandatory starting line, are the reformers saying you need a theology degree to have saving faith? Like, what about a child? Or someone without formal education? Or someone who just doesn't have the cognitive capacity to grasp complex 16th century theological nuances? Does this framework just leave them completely out in the cold?
That is a really crucial objection, and it's actually one the reformers wrestled with quite a bit. But they weren't demanding exhaustive PhD-level mastery of systematic theology.
Okay, that's a relief.
Right. What they were arguing for was just the presence of a specific object of faith. You cannot trust a blank space. So a child can understand the basic data, like, I am broken, and Jesus is a rescuer who loves me.
And that counts as notitia.
Yes, that is notitia. The Apostle Paul lays out this exact logical sequence in the New Testament, specifically in Romans 10. Yeah, he asks us a highly rational question. He says, how then will they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they have never heard?
Wow. Yeah, the progression there is pretty much impossible to argue with.
Right.
You literally have to hear the information before you can process it.
Exactly. It initiates with hearing. Faith engages the mind first. It doesn't bypass the intellect at all. It actually requires it as the starting point.
It's the groundwork.
It is.
Yep.
But, and this brings us to the fatal flaw of stopping at step one. What's fascinating here is that a person can memorize every single historical fact about Christianity, comprehend the deepest nuances of theology. They can pass every seminary exam with flying colors and still not actually be a Christian.
Because notitia alone is entirely insufficient for salvation.
Completely insufficient.
So, okay, I have the data, but I know a lot of facts that I don't actually buy into.
Right.
Like, for example, I understand the plot of a sci-fi movie. Or I comprehend the complex mythology of ancient Greece. I know the stories of Zeus and Apollo inside and out. I possess perfect notitia regarding Greek mythology.
Right, you know the lore.
Exactly. But I don't actually believe those beings literally existed or that those events took place in history. So how did the reformers address the gap between simply understanding a claim and actually buying into its reality?
Well, they addressed it with the second component of the framework, assensus.
Or assent.
Yes, assent.
Yeah.
This is the bridge. Assensus moves you from just understanding a claim to affirming its objective reality.
Okay.
It's the intellectual conviction that the facts we just established in the notitia stage are actually historically, objectively true.
So for a Christian, assensus means not only knowing that a book claims Jesus rose from the dead, but genuinely intellectually believing that the tomb was actually empty on Easter morning.
Exactly. The source text points to Hebrews 11:6 for this, which says, whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him.
So it's a step further.
Yeah. You look at the data provided by your knowledge and your mind makes a judgment call. Your mind says, yes, I affirm that this is true.
You're no longer dealing with mythology.
Right. You are dealing with what you perceive to be concrete reality.
Yeah. And here's where it gets really interesting, though.
Oh, definitely.
Because just when you think you've cracked the code, you know the facts, you agree they are objectively true. The 16th century reformers drop another bombshell.
They do.
Because according to this document, even a census isn't enough to secure your faith.
No, it's not.
And to prove this, they use what the text calls the demon test.
Yeah, and this is arguably one of the most sobering theological concepts in the entire framework.
It really is.
Because it completely shatters the modern assumption that just believing God exists is somehow the finish line.
Right. So let's explore this demon test together.
Yeah.
The clearest biblical proof that assensus isn't enough is found in the book of James, chapter 2, verse 19.
Right.
And the verse says, you believe that God is one, you do well. Even the demons believe and shudder.
It's such a heavy verse.
So heavy.
Yeah.
Let's map that verse onto this three-part framework we're building. Think about the demons. They possess perfect notitia. They've been around since before humanity. They know exactly who Jesus is. They know all the historical data. They know the theology perfectly.
Furthermore, they possess complete assensus.
Right.
They don't think Jesus is a myth. They don't think the resurrection was just some metaphor. They know for a literal objective fact that his claims are true.
They were there.
Exactly. They have full intellectual conviction. They know the facts and they believe the facts are true.
Yet they are absolutely not saved. They believe and they shudder. Why? Like, what is happening psychologically and spiritually in that moment? They have the knowledge, they agree with reality, but they are terrified instead of secured.
Well, they shudder because of their posture toward those facts.
Explain that.
The demons are entirely alienated from God, not because they lack information and not because they doubt the reality of that information, but because their posture is one of active rebellion. They actually hate the very reality they are forced to acknowledge.
Wow.
So it proves that you can have perfect, flawless theology and still be completely lost. Intellect is not the finish line.
Which brings us to the climax of the framework. The third and final component that actually separates a dead, demonic faith from a living, saving faith, fiducia.
Fiducia.
Yes.
Trust.
This is where faith finally moves out of the intellect and actively engages the will.
Because if even demons have knowledge and assent, fiducia has to be the ultimate defining characteristic of true security.
Exactly.
But how exactly does the will engage? Let me see if I can ground this with an analogy from the source document, the airplane one we kind of hinted at earlier.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to visualize it. Okay, so let's say I'm about to take a cross-country flight. First, I study aerodynamics. I read up on thrust, lift, drag. I completely understand the mechanics of how a massive metal tube can fly through the air.
Right, so you have no Tisha. You have the knowledge.
Exactly. Then I go to the airport, I stand at those huge glass windows at the terminal, and I watch planes taking off and landing, I read the safety records online.
Yeah.
And I firmly believe, intellectually, that the Boeing 737 sitting at my gate is a safe, functional aircraft capable of flying to my destination.
So now you have a census. You assent to the reality of the plane's capability.
Right. But I am still standing in the terminal.
Yes.
My belief hasn't actually done anything for me yet. I'm not any closer to my destination.
Right. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this is where the system completely fails without fiducia.
Because I haven't gotten on the plane.
Exactly. You only exercise saving faith fides eva when you scan your boarding pass, step aboard the aircraft, sit in your seat, buckle the seatbelt, and truly trust the pilot with your life to get you to your destination.
You have to commit.
You have to commit. Fiducia is the act of entrusting your soul to the facts. It is a posture of complete reliance, confidence, and dependence on Christ and his gospel.
So it's not just agreeing with a statement.
No, it's no longer just saying, I believe Jesus died for sinners. It is saying, I trust that Jesus died for me, and I am resting my entire standing before God on that specific fact.
Wow. It is the shift from the theoretical to the deeply, terrifyingly personal.
Absolutely. And the source text highlights that this is the exact kind of faith constantly demanded throughout the New Testament.
Okay.
When you read famous passages like John 3.16 or Romans 3.22, the call is never for mere intellectual agreement.
Right. It's not just a trivia test.
Not at all. The Greek words used there imply a personal entrusting of oneself. It is resting entirely on Christ's finished work for your justification.
Instead of relying on your own merits, right, or your own good deeds, or your own religious resume, which requires a massive abandonment of self-reliance.
It does.
And that is incredibly difficult for human beings to do.
Oh, it goes against our core psychology.
Yeah.
We want to be in control. We want to stand in the terminal, evaluate the plane, and, you know, maybe hold onto a parachute just in case the pilot messes up.
Right, just to be safe.
But abandoning self-reliance means admitting you cannot save yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that is exactly what the demons, despite all their flawless knowledge and belief, will never do.
Because of their pride.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They will never surrender their will, give up their autonomy, and trust in Christ as their savior.
And that takes us right back to what Luther and Melanchthon were so desperately trying to communicate to the people of the 16th century.
Yes.
They were looking at a religious culture that was very, very good at hanging out in the airport terminal.
That's a great way to put it.
People knew the stories from the stained glass windows. That was their notitia.
Right.
They nodded their heads and agreed the church's teachings were true. That was their assensus.
Right.
But when it came to their actual spiritual security, they were relying on buying indulgences, completing penance, and their own good works. They weren't actually stepping onto the plane and trusting Christ alone.
They lacked fiducia.
Yeah.
And without that vital trust, the whole system just collapses into religious anxiety. The knowledge and the ascent are necessary. They're the runway that allows the plane to take off.
Because you can't trust a plane you don't believe exists.
Exactly. But without the element of trust, without engaging the will to actually surrender, you are just an educated spectator watching from the window.
So what does this all mean for us today? Let's bring this all together. If we summarize this historic Protestant view, we can see exactly how we arrive at true security in faith. It is this beautiful interlocking mechanism.
It really is.
Without knowledge, without notitia, faith is blind. It's just wishing on a star or jumping out of a plane, hoping a parachute magically appears on your back.
Right, which is dangerous.
Yeah.
Very. Without a census, faith is hypothetical. It's just a fairy tale or a myth that you don't really buy into.
Yeah.
But without trust, without fiducia, faith is dead.
Completely dead.
It's the faith of demons who know the truth but refuse to yield to it. Saving faith, therefore, is not a blind leap into the dark.
Yeah.
And it's not a cold, rational acceptance of a theological exam either.
No, it's a warm, informed, and vital embrace of the truth.
It's the alignment of the mind, which acknowledges the facts, and the will, which surrenders to those facts.
It is stepping onto the plane and taking your seat.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think this raises an important question, though.
Oh.
Something for you listening right now to really mull over as you go about your day.
Yeah.
We've established that fiducia is like finally boarding that airplane, buckling your seatbelt, and trusting the pilot with your life.
Right.
But what happens when that flight hits severe turbulence?
Oh, man. Because the sky isn't always clear, is it?
No, it's not.
The Christian experience isn't a perfectly smooth ride just because you boarded the plane.
Exactly the opposite. Often, when the plane drops suddenly, when the oxygen masks rattle in the overhead compartments, your notitia, your deep knowledge of the physics of aerodynamics might not feel very comforting in that exact second of panic.
Yeah, facts kind of fly out the window when you're terrified.
Right. And even your assentus, your intellectual belief in the safety record of the airline, might severely waver when the cabin is violently shaking.
That's such a good point.
So since fiducia actively engages the will, we have to ask a difficult question about the nature of trust itself.
Which is?
Is true trust just the one-time decision to board the plane at the terminal? Or is fiducia the ongoing, daily, sometimes minute-by-minute choice to stay securely in your seat, keeping your seatbelt fastened, and continuing to rely on the pilot even when every nerve in your body is telling you to panic?
Wow. Is trust an event, or is trust an endurance?
Exactly.
That is a profound question to leave on, because the historical facts of the gospel don't change, but our subjective experience of the turbulence certainly does.
It constantly changes.
I encourage you to really chew on that idea today. Think about where you might just be holding on to knowledge, where you might just be nodding in agreement from the safety of the terminal, and what it might actually look like to stay seated on the plane when the storms roll in.
It's a lot to think about.
It is. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive. We love exploring these concepts with you, peeling back the layers, and finding those insights that challenge how we view the world and our place in it.
Absolutely.
Keep asking the big questions, keep seeking the truth, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.